On the morning of December 1st, 1948, the body of a middle-aged man was found on the shore of Somerton Beach near Adelaide, South Australia. The man was resting against the seawall, slumped forward with a half-smoked cigarette lying on his lapel. He was well-dressed in a suit with polished dress shoes, odd attire for a beach on a summer day. There was no sign of violence or a struggle. The man carried no identification of any kind. The police immediately assumed the man had died of natural causes while taking a stroll on the beach. When no missing persons reports matched up with the body found, they were forced to investigate the matter further. Each clue only led to more questions. In the 70-odd years since the mysterious body was found on the beach, no one has come any closer to discovering the identity of the man, what he was doing on the beach that day, or how he died. Popular theories abound, including a man ending his life in despair after losing his lover and son, or a Cold War spy linked to secret codes and mysterious poisons. With so much evidence lost or destroyed over the decades, and everyone close to the case now deceased, it seems unlikely that we'll ever know the truth. Join me as I present to you Episode 57, The Somerton Man.
Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon.
I'm Ro.
Derek isn't with us tonight. He got stuck at work, so he says hello and that he'll be back really soon. And as you heard from the intro, Ro is up again tonight, and it's a story I'm excited to hear about.
Yeah, I think this covers kind of both of our favorite things. It's in an era we both like. 1948, it's the Cold War era. There's a lot of mystery surrounding this, and it's out of Australia, which we haven't really had anything out of Australia yet, have we?
No, I almost did the Mr. Cruel case out of Australia, but I haven't, that's put it on the back burner right now. So we might have another one coming up soon.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I hope you guys are as excited to hear this as I am to present it to you. So here we go. At 7 p.m. on November 30th, 1948, John Lyons and his wife were taking an evening stroll on Somerton Beach, a small seaside resort just outside of Adelaide, South Australia. They noticed a man lying against a seawall about 60 feet away from them, legs crossed in front of him. He lifted his right arm weakly before dropping it back to the ground as if to wave hello or to maybe even signal for help. The couple assumed he was drunk, trying to smoke a cigarette, and continued on their way. Around 7:30, another couple walking along the seawall saw a man in a similar position. This time, they both noticed the man was not moving at all, despite a mass of mosquitoes swarming his face. The male witness joked that he must be dead to the world to ignore the bugs, but the couple also assumed he was simply in a drunken stupor and moved on. 6:30 a.m. the next morning, which would be December 1st, 1948, John Lyons returned to the beach to meet a friend for an early morning swim. John and his friend both noticed a cluster of people on horseback near the seawall where the body had been the night before. Approaching the group to investigate further, Lyons realized something was wrong when he recognized the body as the man he and his wife had seen the previous evening, and that it was still in the same position as before. He immediately called the police. The body was taken by ambulance to the Royal Adelaide Hospital. Dr. John Bennett examined the body. Now, this wasn't a full autopsy. It was just the initial examination upon entry to the morgue, like SVU and CSI, where they're like at the crime scene, they're like, oh, time of death must have occurred between blah, blah, blah. It was more like that. So this doctor deduced the time of death to be no sooner than 2 a.m. based on the stage of rigor mortis. His report listed the cause of death as heart failure, possibly caused by poisoning, as there were no signs of injury or struggle or obvious illness. The items in the man's possession were also cataloged: an unused train ticket from Adelaide to Henley Beach, a bus ticket from Adelaide to Glenelg, a pack of Juicy Fruit chewing gum, some Bryant and May matches, an aluminum comb, and a pack of Army Club cigarettes containing 7 cigarettes of another, more expensive brand called Kinsitas. The man was very well dressed in a fashionable American tailored suit and heeled shoes, but the maker's labels had been snipped out of the clothes. He was wearing a knit pullover vest and a double-breasted coat, traditionally cool weather clothing, which is strange attire for a summer beach trip in Australia. One pocket of his trousers had been torn away and neatly repaired using bright orange thread. A full autopsy the following day revealed more detail. The man's leg muscles were of particular interest and noted as high and toned. His feet were oddly pointed. Experts surmised that he might have often worn heeled and pointed shoes. Perhaps he may have even been a ballet dancer. It was also noted that his pupils were smaller than normal. His spleen was 3 times the usual size and firm. The liver was distended with congested blood. His stomach contained more blood, along with the remains of a pasty, which for those of us stateside, it's like a chicken pot pie. These observations strengthened the poisoning hypothesis, but lab tests revealed no traces of any known poison. The pasty was also tested and came back negative. The attending pathologist, John Dwyer, was astounded that nothing was found. Thomas Cleland, the coroner, later suggested that there were 2 deadly poisons that decomposed in the body in a short time, leaving no trace. Digitalis and strophanthin. Either could have been used in this case and decomposed before the autopsy was performed. A lack of evidence such as vomiting and undisturbed surroundings that could have proved he suffered convulsions meant that poisoning could not officially be named, since those were 2 telltale signs of that particular death. So what they're saying is, where they found this man's body, there was nothing to indicate that he rolled around, that he convulsed, that he struggled. And there was no like vomit or anything that you might find if someone is having a violent reaction to a poison. The pathologist, Dr. Dwyer, concluded, quote, "I am quite convinced the death could not have been natural. The poison I suggested was a barbiturate or a soluble hypnotic," end quote. Although poisoning remained a prime suspicion, the pasty was not believed to be the source of the poison. Other than that, the coroner was unable to reach a conclusion as to the man's identity, cause of death, or whether the man seen alive at Somerton Beach on the evening of November 30th was the same man, as nobody had seen his face at the time. Digitalis, it should be noted, is used as both a poison and as an ingredient in heart medications. It's derived from a common and popular flower called the foxglove. It's brightly colored and the flowers look like the end of trumpets. And if you Google pictures of them, they're usually like really bright red or violet or orange. Some of them are purple. They're actually really pretty. Strophanthin is derived from an African plant and was widely used to treat shock and to resuscitate people, like epinephrine is nowadays. However, too much would also cause death. It was popular in the 1930s and fell out of favor in the 1970s in most medical practices worldwide. This wasn't the end of the case, however. Fingerprints and an extremely detailed description of the Somerset man were sent to law enforcement agencies throughout the world. The FBI even analyzed his fingerprints. The detailed description was even circulated in newspapers worldwide. The description of the man was as followed. He was 5'11", or 180 centimeters. He had gray eyes. His hair was a, and now I'm quoting from the newspaper, his hair was a mousy ginger color, graying around the sides and receding in the front. He was estimated to be between 40 and 50 years old. he was uncircumcised, which was not a popular option prior to, I'm going to say probably the 80s is when it started, at least in the U.S. is when it became a popular option. So I have to include that. And also it was in the newspaper. So he weighed between 165 to 175 pounds or 75 to 80 kilograms. He was missing 18 teeth, including his two lateral incisors, which were most likely never grown in due to a genetic defect known as hypodontia. This is important later on. He had small scars on his left wrist, left forearm, and left elbow. His hands and feet were clean and callus-free, indicating he did not do manual labor. In addition to worldwide exposure, police put out a call to travel agencies, dry cleaners, hotels, train stations, and any other service that was heavily used within the hospitality and travel industry. They assumed that because the Somerton man was dressed in more formal attire than was required for a beach trip, that he had been or was traveling. The assumption proved to be correct when on January 14, 1949, the Adelaide Railway Station reported a suitcase that had been checked in on November 30th and hadn't been claimed. They believed it had belonged to the man found on the beach. Inside the suitcase were red checked pajamas, a size 7, pair of red felt slippers, 4 pairs of underpants, shaving items, a light brown pair of trousers with sand in the cuffs, an electrician screwdriver, a table knife cut into a short, sharp instrument, so basically a shiv, a pair of scissors with sharpened points, a small square of zinc thought to have been used as a protective sheath for the knife and scissors, and a stenciling brush as used by third officers on merchant ships for stenciling cargo. Also in the suitcase was a thread card of Barber brand orange waxed thread, an unusual type not available in Australia. It was the same as that used to repair the lining in the pocket of the trousers the dead man was wearing. All identification marks on the clothes had been removed, but police found the name T. Keen on a tie, Keen on a laundry bag, and Keen on a singlet, which was like a ribbon, along with 3 dry cleaning marks. With wartime rationing still enforced, clothing was difficult to acquire at the time. Although it was a very common practice to use name tags, it was also common when buying secondhand clothing to remove those tags of previous owners. What was unusual was that there were no socks found in the suitcase and no correspondence, although the police did find pencils and unused stationery. A search concluded that no T. Keen was missing in any English-speaking country. A nationwide circulation of the dry cleaning tags also proved fruitless. All that could be garnered from the suitcase was that the front gusset and feather stitching on the coat found in the case indicated that it had been manufactured in the United States. So the stitching on the sides of the coats was specific to United States or like American tailoring and fashion, which I actually found pretty fascinating that clothing was so well tailored that you could tell what country it was made in just by the stitching. To me, that's like a fascinating little rabbit hole to climb into. The coat had not been imported, indicating the man had been to the United States or bought the coat from someone of a similar size who had been to the States. Police checked incoming train records and believe the man had arrived at the Adelaide Railway Station by overnight train from either Melbourne, Sydney, or Port Augusta. They speculated he had showered and shaved at the adjacent city baths, before returning to the train station to purchase a ticket for the 10:50 a.m. train to Henley Beach, which, for whatever reason, he missed or didn't catch. He immediately checked his suitcase at the station cloakroom before leaving the station and catching a city bus for nearby Glenelg. An inquest into the man's death conducted by coroner Thomas Cleland commenced a few days following the discovery of the body, as we've just went over. But the conclusion of that inquest and the full breadth of that inquest was put on hiatus until June 17, 1949. Cleland, as the investigating pathologist, re-examined the body and made a number of discoveries. He noted that the man's shoes were remarkably clean and appeared to have been recently polished, rather than in the condition expected of a man who had apparently been wandering around the town of Glenelg all day. He added that this evidence fit in with a popular theory that the body may have been brought to Somerton Park Beach after the man's death, accounting for lack of evidence of vomiting and convulsions, which are the two main physiological reactions to poisoning. Leland speculated that as none of the witnesses could positively identify the man they saw the previous night as the same person discovered the next morning, there remained the possibility that the man had died elsewhere and had been dumped. He stressed that this was purely speculation, as all the witnesses believed it was, quote, definitely the same person, end quote, as the body was in the same place and lying in the same distinctive position. He also found no evidence indicating the identity of the deceased. So with all this physical evidence they found, like his possessions and all that, there's still no name and still no identity. Cedric Stanton Hicks, professor of physiology and pharmacology at the University of Adelaide, testified that a group of drugs, variants of a drug in that group he called number one, and in particular number two, were extremely toxic in a relatively small oral dose that would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to identify, even if it had been suspected in the first instance. He gave Cleland a piece of paper with the names of the two drugs, which was entered into police files as Exhibit C-18. The names were not released to the public until the 1980s, as at the time they were quite easily procurable by the ordinary individual from a chemist, which is a pharmacist to us here stateside, without the need to give a reason for the purchase. These drugs were later publicly identified as Digitalis and Oobane, which I mentioned earlier, it was the African plant that the coroner had suspected. Hicks noted that the only fact not found in relation to the body was again evidence of vomiting and convulsions. He then stated that its absence was not unknown, but that he could not make a frank conclusion without it. Hicks stated that if death had occurred 7 hours after the man was last seen to move, it would imply a massive dose that would still have been undetectable. It was noted that the movement seen by witnesses at 7 p.m. could have been the last convulsion preceding death. Earlier in the inquiry, Cleland stated, quote, I would be prepared to find that he died from poison, that the poison was probably a glucoside, and that it was not accidentally administered. But I cannot say whether it was administered by the deceased himself or by some other person or persons, end quote. Despite these findings, he could not determine the cause of death of the unidentified man. Cleland remarked that if the body had been carried to its final resting place, then all difficulties would disappear. After the inquest, a plaster cast was made of the man's head and shoulders. The lack of success in determining the identity and cause of death of the man had led authorities to call it an unparalleled mystery and believe that the cause of death might never be known. Now, here's where the mystery deepens and starts to head into what I feel like resembles an old-fashioned spy thriller. Like we're getting into some James Bond stuff, some five Cussler books, like that kind of stuff. And this is what got me excited about this case. During the time of the inquest in June, which is now 7 months after the Somerset man is found, authorities find a clue that both helps the case, but also deepens the mystery as to who the Somerset man was. A very tiny piece of rolled up paper with the words Tamam Shud printed on it was found in a fob pocket, or what we call a watch pocket. You know, that cool inside pocket in men's jackets that we ladies wish would come sewn into our jackets. Well, this was sewn within the dead man's trouser pocket. So a pocket sewn inside another pocket. Public library officials were called in to translate the text and identified it as a phrase meaning ended or finished, found on the last page of a book of poetry called the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And this was a Persian poet, and this book had been translated from Persian to English in the 1800s. It was very popular from the 30s to the 50s. The paper's backside was blank, indicating that it had been torn from the page of a book. Police conducted an Australia-wide search to find a copy of the book that had a similar font and formatting. A photograph of the scrap of paper was released to the press, and I think I sent you that picture earlier, Brandon. I mean, there's nothing remarkable about it. It's just a little tiny scrap. Maybe the only thing remarkable is that it was such a tiny scrap of paper, because we all know book fonts are small anyway. And if it's just two words, imagine how small that little scrap of paper was.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So following a public appeal by police, the copy of the Rubaiyat from which the page had been torn was actually located. A man showed police a 1941 edition of Edward Fitzgerald's 1859 translation of the Rubaiyat, published by Whitcomb and Toombs in Christchurch, New Zealand. Detective Sergeant Lionel Lean, who led the investigation at the time, protected the privacy of the witness in public statements. He referred to this man who found the book by the pseudonym of Ronald Francis, and this man has never officially been identified. Francis had not considered that the book might be connected to the case until he had seen an article in the previous day's newspaper. Reports seem to differ on when exactly Francis found this book, but most reports show that he found a copy of the book tossed in the back of his unlocked car and lying on the floorboard. He had no connection to the dead man or the book at all. They knew this was the book that this came from because it was actually on that page. It was missing. Like you found where it was torn out, the little piece of paper. So the theme of the Rubaiyat is that one should live life to the fullest and have no regrets when it ends. The poem's subject led police to theorize that maybe the man had committed suicide by poison, although no other evidence corroborated the theory. Microscopic tests indicated that the piece of paper was from the page torn from the book. Also in the back of the book were faint indentations representing five lines of text in capital letters. Initially, the letters were thought to be words in a foreign language, as the letters strung together didn't form any known English words, before it was realized that it was a code. Code experts were called in at the time to decipher the lines, but were unsuccessful. A telephone number was also found in the back of the book, belonging to a nurse named Jessica Thompson. Now, Jessica Thompson has a few different names and aliases. She was born Jessie Harkness, so you may hear me refer to her as that. And Jessie Thompson is her other one. And then sometimes, if you want to look this case up on your own, she's referred to as Jetson, which is a nickname. So Jessie Harkness, or Thomas, actually lived in the town of Glenelg, about 400 meters north of the location where the body was found. When she was interviewed by police, Thompson said that she did not know the dead man or why he would have her phone number and choose to visit her suburb on the night of his death. However, She also reported that sometime in late 1948, a strange man had attempted to visit her and was asking her neighbors about her. Jessica was very reluctant to speak with the police, and they seemed reluctant to press her for details. For a long time, they even hid her identity. Her excuse for being a reluctant witness was that she was, at the time, living with a man who she would later marry. She was very worried about a scandal arising, but digging into her past a bit more seems like she knew a lot more than she might be letting on. Regardless of her reason for keeping quiet, Jessica denied any knowledge of the case, but did admit to giving a copy of the Rubaiyat to another man named Alfred Boxall. Jessica had been an army nurse during World War II, and Boxall was an officer. She gave him the book when they met in an army hospital and had it inscribed with one of the verses of poetry that she signed with her nickname, Jetson. The police decided that the unknown man must then be Alfred Boxall, and were quite disappointed when they found him a few days later. He was alive, and he was still bearing his copy of the Rubaiyat, complete with Jessica's inscription, on the last page. It was not the same unique edition that the dead man had possessed. Jessica was then asked to come to the police station and was shown the plaster cast of the Somerset man. Her reaction was one of shock. Witnesses present during her identification felt certain that she knew who this man was. Upon seeing his face, Detective Sergeant Lean noted that she seemed, quote, completely taken aback to the point of giving the appearance she was about to faint, end quote. She was only shown a cast that had been made of his face and not the actual body, so this shock was not due to being faced with a dead body. Even if it had been, as a nurse, she had already experienced being faced with death and sickness, so her reaction would have been suspicious, especially because this was just like a plain run-of-the-mill plaster cast. It was a good plaster cast, but, you know, it wasn't painted in. There was no, like, not like the plaster casts we've seen, like, in the Cleveland Butcher case. Like, those were scary, and yes, you would have a reaction to those. This looked more like a kid's statue model or something. So her reaction, everyone thought, was suspicious. It was clear to many that she recognized this man based off that reaction. But she continued to deny any connection to him, and no physical evidence could be linked to her. At this time, police were decidedly at a dead end. The Somerset man was given a burial by the Salvation Army, and the funeral and burial was paid for by the South Australian Grandstand Bookmakers Association, who wanted to save him the indignity of a pauper's burial. For months until 1972, flowers began to appear on his grave. However, no one was ever caught leaving them there. As the years have gone by, new evidence and suppressed records have come to light. Unfortunately, key original evidence has been lost or destroyed as well. The South Australian Police Historical Society is where the plaster bust can be found. It should also be noted that it was discovered that plaster bust has a few strands of this man's hair, which they have tried to get DNA from, which is kind of interesting. Any further attempts to identify the body have been hampered by the embalming process. Formaldehyde is used in that method, and it destroys DNA quickly. So other key evidence no longer exists, such as the brown suitcase, which was destroyed in 1986. In addition, witness statements have also disappeared from the police file over the years. Now, this case is still ongoing. It's even been updated in the press. So in 2009, a professor named Derek Abbott began an attempt to solve the case through trying to crack the mysterious code written in the Somerton man's copy of the Rubaiyat, and proposing to exhume the body and test for DNA. His investigations have led to questions concerning the assumptions police have made on the case. Now, Derek Abbott, from 2009 until present day, he's sort of like the lead man for this. He's the go-to guy. He's got papers published on it at the University of Adelaide in Australia. He's very active in the investigation as far as consulting, and he's also a press liaison. I'll post some really good links to some of his stuff in our show notes. So starting with the decryption of the code, Professor Abbott started from scratch. Like, he disregarded all theories and notes and just started completely from scratch. And it has been determined that the letter frequency was considerably different from the letters written down randomly. The frequency was further tested to determine if perhaps the alcohol level of the writer could alter that random distribution. So basically, they're trying to see if this was just drunk scribbling or if this really was a code, is what their theory was, or at least that's to my understanding. The format of the code also appears to follow the poetic format of the Rubaiyat, supporting the theory that the code was a one-time pad encryption algorithm. Copies of the Rubaiyat, as well as the Talmud and the Bible, are being compared to the code using computers to get a statistical base for letter frequencies. However, the code's short length meant the investigators would require the exact edition of the book used to create that code. With the original copy of the Somerton man's Rubaiyat lost in the 1950s, researchers have been looking for a matching edition. Now, this code that I'm referring to, if you join our Facebook group, the 3AM Mystery Club, I'll have all those pictures posted in there, and then we'll put them up on Instagram as well, so you can check that out and see what I'm talking about. An investigation had shown that the Somerton man's autopsy reports of 1948 and 1949 are also missing. And the Barr Smith's library collection of the pathologist Dr. Cleland's notes do not contain anything on the case. So that doctor who did this autopsy, his notes on that case are missing out of his private collection as well as out of the official collection, which is sus to me. A professor of anatomy at the University of Adelaide recently examined images of the Somerton man's head, and she found that his ears, the upper ear hollow, is larger than the lower ear hollow, which I didn't really understand what that meant in the pictures either. But apparently it is something really rare. It's a feature possessed by only 1-2% of the Caucasian population. In May 2009, Professor Abbott consulted with dental experts who concluded that the Somerton man had hypodontia, which is a genetic disorder of both lateral incisors, a feature present in only 2% of the general population. In June 2010, Professor Abbott obtained a photograph of Jessica Thompson, the mystery woman that I mentioned earlier, of her eldest son, Robin, which clearly showed that he, like the unknown man, had not only the ear thing going on, but also he had hypodontia. The chance that this was a coincidence has been estimated as between 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 10 million and 1 in 20 million. So, I don't know. It seems to me like Miss Jessica knew a little bit more than she might have been letting on. Anyway, Abbott believes an exhumation and a DNA test could link the Somerton man to a short list of surnames, which, along with existing clues to the man's identity, would be the final piece of the puzzle. In July 2013, Professor Abbott released an artistic impression he commissioned of the Somerton Man, believing this might finally lead to an identification. Abbott says, "All this time, we've been publishing autopsy photos, and it's hard to tell what someone looks like from that." Which is true, because an autopsy photo, you know, they're deceased, their face is usually swollen or shrunken depending on when the photo was taken and their time of death. Their eyes are closed, they don't have any facial expressions. So it is from autopsy photos versus a real life photo, there is a big difference. And another strange twist to the case, in 2010, Professor Abbott married a woman named Rachel Egan. Rachel is the daughter of Robin Thomas, which hypothetically means he may have married the granddaughter of the Somerton Man. In December 2017, Professor Abbott announced three hairs at the right development state were at the right development stage for extracting DNA, and they have been found on that plaster cast of the corpse, and they have been submitted to analysis, or they have been submitted for analysis to the Australian Center for Ancient DNA at the University of Adelaide. Processing the results could take up to a year. So that was in 2017. A lot of the DNA has been degraded due to embalming process. So he was embalmed before the plaster cast was made, is why I keep saying that. Now, in February 2018, the University of Adelaide was able to obtain mitochondrial DNA from the hair sample of the Somerton Man. However, unfortunately, mitochondrial DNA is only inherited through the maternal line, and therefore cannot be used to investigate a hereditary link between Rachel Egan and the Somerton Man, which basically means, and I'm paraphrasing here because otherwise we're getting into a lot of sciencey stuff, which works around in my brain the same way math stuff does, and we run into problems. Anyway, they could identify basically the ethnicity and narrow down the region he was from with it. As a Caucasian male, it seemed there were no surprises in finding out that he was of European descent. In May 2021, which is the latest update on this case, permission was finally granted to exhume the body of the Somerton Man to do a full forensic workup, with hopes that the embalming process and the condition of the body will not hinder the scientific process. Professor Abbott remains cautious about the process, saying in a recent interview with ABC News Australia, "Who knows what the condition is? If roots have gone through it, like tree roots, it could be in very poor condition, but at least it hasn't visibly sunken like some of the other graves," he said. "This man is buried on top of two other people from a previous century. When your lease runs out, the cemetery authority can bury somebody on top of you, and that's what's happened. One would hope that the bones of all three haven't got mixed up and there's sufficient separation between all three, but who knows?" End quote. Professor Abbott also said finding a match would be difficult and that researchers may need as many as 800,000 DNA markers. "All you're doing is finding relatives through DNA," he said. "Once you find those relatives, the idea is that you can look at their family trees and triangulate their family trees and find a stop somewhere that's a bloke missing in 1948, and that's your man," end quote. The results are pending from that because the excavation was done in May of 2021, and this could take a few years to get any definitive answers in. Now, it's time for our theories. There are two popular theories revolving around the Somerset Man, and they both have something to do with Jessica Thompson. Years after the case went cold, as Jessica's son Robin grew older, media outlets began to remark about the timeline of his birth and his resemblance to the photo of the Somerset Man. A popular theory is that Jessica had been seeing both Alan Boxall and the Somerset Man and given them both copies of the Rubaiyat. Like I said earlier, it was a very popular book of poetry between 1930 and 1950. There are even like book clubs just centered on this book and discussing this book at that time. They believe that Robin was perhaps the son of the Somerset man, but for some reason, Jessica didn't want to acknowledge him. Maybe because she was getting married to someone else and wanted to pass the baby off as her new husband. The theory is that the heartbroken Somerset man had tried to make contact with her over the year, and when he was rejected, he committed suicide. However, that still doesn't account for the lack of evidence surrounding the body and the police and coroner's theory that the body had been placed on the beach. Unless, in my thinking, and this is just purely my thinking, the Rowena wild theory going on, he ingested poison at Jessica's home, and then she and her fiance moved him to the beach, which was very, very close to her house. Now, theory two, which is my personal favorite theory and probably the internet's favorite theory, spies. In November 2013, relatives of Jessica gave interviews to the Channel 9 current affairs program 60 Minutes out of Australia. Kate Thompson, the daughter of Jessica and her husband Prosper Thompson, who is who she married right after this whole Somerton man investigation, said that her mother was the woman interviewed by the police and that her mother had told her she had lied to the police. Jessica did know the identity of the Somerton man, and his identity was also, quote, known to a level higher than the police force, end quote. Thompson's father Prosper died in 1995 and her mother Jessica died in 2007. She suggested that her mother and the Somerton man may both have been spies, noting that Jessica taught English to migrants, was highly interested in communism, and could speak Russian fluently, although she would not disclose to her daughter where she had learned it or why. There is also another mysterious and similar death that occurred around the same time, in which both the Rubiot and Jessica Thompson can be loosely associated. Joseph George Marshall was a Jewish immigrant from Singapore who passed away in 1945. A few years before the Somerton man was found, Marshall was found in Ashton Park in Sydney with a copy of the Rubaiyat open on his chest. The death was ruled a suicide by poisoning. His version was published by a London publishing house and was a seventh edition. It appears that Marshall's copy of the Rubaiyat was as unique as the Somerton man's copy was. So somebody is handing out very rare copies of this book, and then those people who possess that are somehow dying. Perhaps these books were really one-time pads used by specific intelligent rings to encode messages to each other. Jessica gave Alfred Boxhall a copy of Rubaiyat in Clifton Gardens just 2 months after Marshall was found dead. Clifton Gardens is next to Ashton Park. This links her to all three men. She gave Boxall a copy of the Rubaiyat over drinks. Her phone number was written in the unknown man's copy of the Rubaiyat, and she was in the immediate area when Marshall was found dead with a copy of the Rubaiyat on his chest. Was Thompson a main link in a spy chain? Marshall was the brother of the Chief Minister of Singapore. When an inquest was held for his death, a woman named Gwyneth Dorothy Graham testified. She was found dead 2 weeks later, her wrist slit in a bathtub. Now, on a purely superficial note, if you look at a recent rendering of the Somerset man, he looks like what you imagine a World War II spy would look like. He's very James Bond in this picture. My personal theory is that Jessica Thompson absolutely was in a spy ring with Marshall, Boxall, and the Somerton man. I'm thinking that while she was romantic with at least two of these men, Boxall and the Somerset man, things were getting dangerous in the spy game and she knew it. She elected to cut ties and marry a normal guy in the form of her husband, Prosper Thompson, and raise her baby, whose real father was the Somerset man, as the progeny of this ordinary guy, thus saving herself and her baby from danger. I mean, two people she was connected to got killed in a very suspicious and similar way. I would be keeping my mouth shut too. So, do you have any thoughts on what I've told you so far, Brandon?
Yeah, I think I agree with your theories. Yeah, she was definitely a part of it. The thing that I'm thinking is that with that, the scrap of paper and what it means, like the end or it's over or finished or whatever. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was suicide, because that was one of the thoughts, right? An early theory.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like he, drank untraceable poison himself. And because there was no, there were no struggle signs or anything like that, but that was my thinking, but I don't understand why. I mean, I guess he had his reasons. I guess he was like serious about his job. Like, all right, yes. Like, I got busted, so now I'm going to end it. I guess that's, it's like a suicide bomber almost.
Like the Cold War spies, like when they were caught, the Russian spies would take cyanide.
Yeah. But cyanide would have been traceable, right?
Right. Yeah.
I wonder if when they, when the body was exhumed, I wonder if they can find traces of things now that they couldn't then. Like, I know from being a true crime fan that succinylcholine is like that. Like, you can't trace it. It, like, kills people pretty easily, but you can't trace it. But I feel like they've now developed a way to actually trace that as well. So I wonder if there's something like that that they could find in the body now.
Yeah, and that was actually the official reason for exhuming the body. Like, that's why the officials in Australia gave permission to exhume the body now, because there had been previous attempts to do it before and they were denied. Well, the new person in charge has said, well, we have all this technology now, maybe we'll be able to find something we couldn't back then.
Yeah, I know they were looking for like DNA that hasn't been destroyed, but what could they do with the DNA? Were they still thinking about doing the mitochondrial angle, trying to find like a relative or how?
Yeah. So, how they are finding serial killers now.
Yeah.
So they're trying to go about that angle. Like they're hoping they can find DNA and put it in a public database and get some hits. And then they'll be able to match. Like when you get a match, it can tell you that this is probably your fourth cousin, or this is probably your son or your brother.
Right.
And so with that and working up a family tree, they're hoping they can narrow it down and then possibly identify him that way, like they do with like they did with what was it, the Green River Killer? Is that
the Golden State Killer?
Yeah, the Golden State Killer.
Yeah, he's definitely a spy. I think that he had been to the U.S. too, which is where he bought his clothing. So I feel like he was probably,
Yeah. So that's my thinking. And then where it said that he had legs and feet like that of a ballet dancer, I immediately thought Russian spy.
Oh yeah. Because spies would be like trained in many different areas to disguise themselves. So he was, probably a ballet dancer and probably played the violin and all kinds of things. And who knows what he did in the U.S. when he was there doing his spy things.
Right. And, just from in popular culture, because I'm not really a spy person, it seems like that was kind of Russia's MO back in the Cold War days. Like they would train people in the arts to be spies.
Yeah.
Because they could gain access just about anywhere, because you would get special dispensations as an artist to go perform for public officials and things like that. So, So to me, that was kind of my first flag where I was like, oh, he's a spy. and then my thinking is along yours, like he probably killed himself. He probably, like my theory with Jessica, they probably both knew like the jig is up. Like been caught, like maybe they weren't supposed to be hooking up or something. And they were just like, hey, we're caught. Our goose is cooked. We're done. It's time to say our goodbyes. And then they split ways and he just ended it rather than face being caught and putting maybe his family in danger. Because, you know, there's no proof that that kid, that Robin, her son, is Somerset Maugham's son. But the hypodontia and the ear thing where it was like 1 in 10 million.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty good indicator that they're related somehow.
Yeah. There was a part of me that was thinking, well, if he killed himself and he was that dedicated to his job, why did he leave himself so exposed? But then I was like, but he did a good job covering who he was. So nobody still knows today, you know, over 70 years later. So it's like, I guess it didn't matter.
And then his suitcase, I want to go back to that, where they found like stamp kits and stencils and stuff. To me, that just screams forgery, which is also another spy forte.
Yeah.
So I want to know, I really, really hope we get some audience feedback on this episode, because I want to know what your all's theories out there are. Like, I think this is a good discussion case, and I really want to know what you all think.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of theories on the case. I'm not super familiar with it, but I know a little bit about it. Like, I know that there's Stephen King based part of The Colorado Kid, his novel The Colorado Kid, on this case. It's not, I mean, not the case, but it's kind of like inspired by it. So I remember it from that a little bit too. But yeah, I would love to hear some of those extra theories, something that doesn't involve being a spy, because there's going to be, because that's the big one and that's the most likely one. But, and I want to hear more, I want to know more about his ties to the U.S. I don't think he just bought his clothing, you know, from someone. But right. the DNA testing they could do did decide he was a European man, right?
Yeah, but also, you know, when I got my ancestry DNA pack, it said I was 40% British.
Yeah.
And so,
and somebody being born in what, the 1900s, they would be even less removed than we are today. So, from their ancestry. So, yeah, that, you know, who knows where he was really from.
Right, right. And there was a small blip. I didn't mention it in the main case. Someone rummaging through some papers, you know, in Mama's attic, found like an identification card of someone who resembled what they thought was a younger Somerton man. That has been kind of debunked now, but it was a British, like a British ID card, basically. It was handwritten from the 1920s, which would have been a good age, like the right age, because this man was estimated between 40s and 50s when he passed. So, I mean, that's another, if it's a valid clue, which I didn't include it because it was sketchy and hard to prove, but right. That could prove that he's from England.
Yeah.
But yeah, the jacket thing I thought was just a really cool detail, that tailoring, like clothes were so important back then, and tailoring was so important of a thing back then, that they could just tell from the stitching that this was not a coat made here in this country.
Yeah. So the tags were removed, I guess, part of maybe so they couldn't be identified. I mean,
yeah, because it was really common back then, you know, your clothes were handmade, and even the clothes that you bought from the department store were always altered to fit you better, and they would always stitch your name in those clothes.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so everything had been cut out. All the labels from the clothes were cut out.
They also had that secret pocket. Like, that wasn't just a watch pocket. That was a secret pocket sewn into his actual pants, right?
Right. Yeah. So like, when I looked up what a fob pocket was, I thought fob watch. So that's like the secret compartment inside like a men's sports jacket where you can put your wallet and stuff. But yeah. This was sewn into his pants, like it was a pocket sewn within a pocket in his pants. So it took like I don't know if the purpose of that paper was to not be found or was to have someone really search hard for it, but it was hidden in there good.
Well, I think that's where the poison was hidden.
Yes. Oh, that's a good point.
Because, you know, he didn't have any weapons on him or anything, and like, so and all spies often don't. They use, like, you know, things like poison or their hands or something like that. Like, they're not always going to have just a gun on them or whatever.
Yeah, they MacGyver it.
Right, exactly.
And if you know what MacGyvering is, you're really old like us.
Well, MacGyver, wait, it's back on TV, right? Or it was. So.
It was for a little while, yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe not too old.
You know what? They watched it. Yeah, and also, and I looked up the photos of him, like the autopsy photos. He looked like Harvey Keitel, but then the reconstruction was like amazing. Like,
yeah, like the two completely different people almost.
And he also kind of didn't look like a spy, but I think that was probably what made him a good spy.
Yeah, you wanted to be able to blend into a crowd.
Yeah, and he didn't look like James Bond, which every James Bond has always just stuck out. Like a sort of thing because he was too handsome.
Yeah, this guy just looked like every guy ever.
Another thing I thought of was when they first saw the body on the beach, and like, oh, he's just laying there, he's just drunk. No, my first thought would have been, oh, he's dead. I see people all the time that I think are dead, and they're not. So, of course, you know, times are different now.
Yeah. That's like, this is not related to the story, but it just, what you said just made me think of something. When I pick up the kids in the school line, I remember one time I was so tired, I fell asleep. And I woke up because people were surrounding me, tapping on the glass. So I think they thought I was dead.
They're about the Narcan, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought maybe next time I should put up a sign that I was just napping and I didn't need Narcan.
Yeah, but the mosquito flying around his face should have clued them in right away.
Yeah, that's, I mean, no matter how asleep you are, even subconsciously, your body's gonna jerk or jump or something if a swarm of bugs is on you.
Yeah, this was an interesting discussion and case. It makes me think of our old friend DB Cooper. Like, there's just so many unanswered questions with lots of clues and evidence, but no definitive nothing. Like,
right, it's tons of evidence, no answers. It's, yeah, which is what makes it a good mystery.
Yeah, it's right up there with the DB Cooper, although I don't think it's as known. I know a lot of people do know about it, as Greg mentioned, and Stephen King has based something on it, but I don't, yeah, I hope some people decide to deep dive into it and give us a discussion.
Yeah, I do too. And while you're deep diving, don't forget to check out our website where you can find our merchandise. I know, you know, we try to update it every now and then. My mom mentioned actually that she was going to get a fanny pack, which I'm really excited about.
Nobody's gotten a fanny pack, right? Yeah. Right.
No. So I told her she needs to get it because she'll be the only person in the world right now with a 3 a.m. Mystery Club fanny pack. So she was like, all right, I'm on it.
I'm wearing my t-shirt right now. Not on purpose. I just happen to have it on today. It looks good in purple, by the way. You guys should check it out.
Well, you know, my kids keep stealing my mug too. I keep wanting, like, I keep getting excited I'm going to use it for my coffee. It's always got juice in it and stuff, so I'm gonna have to get more mugs, I think.
I have the mug. I never drink stuff out of a mug because I'm not a coffee or tea person, so I just use it for my pens.
Well, there you go, that works. But yeah, so you can check out all that. If you really want to help us out but you can't really buy anything right now, what you can do is you can like, subscribe, and comment on your favorite podcast streamer, especially on Apple Podcasts. That really helps us get out there and it supports us. And all you have to do is, you know, take up 30 seconds of your time to rate us and subscribe to us. So that would also really help us out if you would be so inclined. But yeah, until next time, guys, thanks for listening. We really appreciate you.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.